Those memories are now out of date. Lieutenant Colonel Tristan Lyons remains on active deed in that DTAP. Meanwhile, I've also been asked to share a little bit of information about Diachronic Shear, since most of us weren't on the scene yet the last time it happened. What I've got below is a helpful mnemonic to bide you over, until one of the real pros has time to write up something more detailed. Feel free to print this out and post it in break rooms, etc. More to come soon. Peace out, Mortimer. Diachronic Shear. You cringe, you singe. Ravstic Wardot. Run. A common mistake at the onset of a diachronic shear event is to reflexively shield oneself from eruptions of bodily fluids and flaming gobbets, thus losing precious moments that could be spent putting distance between yourself and the epicenter. A rift between universes is no place to be fussy. You can always clean up later. Amputate. Body parts that unfortunately found themselves on the wrong side of the rift may seem to remain attached. Intense glamour and general disorientation may hide their misshapen form. Many victims will be unwilling to believe in the reality of what has happened to them. The temptation may be strong to leave these attached and hope for the best. Don't do it. Think of it as being like gangrene, except faster. Fires. Extinguish. Most diachronic shear events are recorded in the history books as epic fires of unknown origin. That's because, after the shear itself is over and done with, fires remain, and find plentiful fuel in destroyed structures. Nipping these in the bud may prevent enormous loss of life in the coming hours. Shore up crumbling structures. Buildings may have lost primary structural members during the shear. Ones that haven't collapsed already may be prevented from doing so with stopgap measures. When in doubt, get out. Tourniquets. Apply as needed. This is an elementary first aid procedure that may save the lives of some who were caught along the boundary of the shear. Intimidate witnesses. Rumors spawned by a shear event may trigger a cascade of aftershocks, as well as compromising your cover story. Do whatever it takes to discourage witnesses from saying anything to their friends and loved ones about what they have seen. Given the nature of what goes on during a shear, this will commonly involve some sort of appeal to whatever gods, demons, or other supernatural forces figure into the locals' belief system. Quell civil disturbances. Panicked bystanders may react in a way that will only inflict further human suffering, as well as making it difficult for you to get homed. Use your pre-established alibi. As part of standard operating procedures, doers should always have alibis and explanations handy for any discrepancies that may be called to their attention by curious and meddlesome locals. Anything you can do to place yourself far from the scene of the shear will help you get home. Observe. This one's far down the list because it's a lower priority, but it's still a priority. Dodo is always eager to gather more data on what happens during a diachronic shear, and so any observations that can be committed to memory will be welcome once you get home. Return to the 21st century. This is self-explanatory. Find your KCW and get homed as soon as possible. If a shear has occurred in your DTAP, it means that your operation has been blown, and there's no point in your staying around. Document. Get to a debriefing room as quickly as possible and record everything you remember while it's fresh in your mind. Opiates. Medical research conducted during the Iraq War has confirmed that immediate administration of morphine following a traumatic event can prevent post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. Our medicine cabinet is well stocked, and we have personnel standing by trained in the prompt and proper administration of this therapy. Therapy. As all doers will be aware from their HR portfolios, the benefits package includes state-of-the-art healthcare with no arbitrary distinctions made between physical and mental health. These benefits are your right. Don't hesitate to use them.
Post by Dr. Roger Blevins on Department Heads Odin Channel, 15-32-37. Day 1808. CC Lieutenant General Octavian K. Frank.
General Frank has asked me to present an account of the confusing and regrettable events preceding and following the disappearance of one of our muons, Rachel Bot Avraham. Please note that this is a confidential and privileged communication for senior management only. You may disseminate relevant facts to your subordinates on a need-to-know basis. I must begin by emphasizing that none of these events were within my power to alter, in large part due to the somewhat decentralized nature of our current org chart and the inherent limitations of managing Anachrons, Muons, and other personalities who are not a good match for modern organizational discipline. Having said that, below is a summary of events courtesy of Macy Stoll after interviewing all relevant witnesses. I believe at this point you are aware, at least anecdotally, of most of what happened, but you may consider the following account definitive. Per established HR procedures, Dr. Blevins was interviewing Rachel Bot Avraham in conference room number 2. This was a quarterly review of the sort normally conducted by Lieutenant Colonel Lyons, but since Lieutenant Colonel Lyons was away on a deed, Dr. Blevins had decided to conduct the review himself. Under normal circumstances, this interview would have been unremarkable. Rachel's personnel record indicated a few areas that were in need of improvement, which Dr. Blevins brought up in the conversation as a matter of course. Dr. Blevins reported after the incident that Rachel showed signs of being under considerable emotional distress, presumably related to the upcoming climax of our 1203 Constantinople operations and possible repercussions for the family and friends she left behind in that DTAP. Rachel became highly emotional and announced her intention to return home at once. Dr. Blevins reminded her that this was forbidden. A confrontation developed, and Dr. Blevins informed her that he would summon DOSECOPS if needed to prevent her from gaining access to an ODEC. She reached into her purse and drew out a small canister of pepper spray, which she discharged in Dr. Blevins's general direction. He did not sustain a direct hit, but the cloud of spray drifted into his face and created intense irritation of the eyes and nasal passages, forcing him to leave the conference room and grope his way down the hall to the men's washroom, where he washed his face in a sink for several minutes before recovering to the point where he could summon DOSECOPS. By that time, Rachel had long since fled the room. Subsequent review of security camera footage shows that Rachel proceeded via the back stairwell to the cellar level, where she entered the biocontainment area and passed directly through it without performing any of the required decontamination procedures. ODEC numbers 1 through 3 were vacant, but ODEC number 4 was occupied by Nadia Cole, a Muon in training recruited only 3 months ago. She was using the ODEC to do homework related to her training program. She was not there to send anyone, nor does she yet have the seniority or training required to do so. Because of Rachel's seniority, Nadia did not question her when she requested entry to the ODEC. Once the two of them were closed up together inside of ODEC number 4, we lose the thread of the story, since our only witness is Nadia, and it appears that Rachel employed magical techniques of some sort to cloud her judgment and induce her to home Rachel back to 1203 Constantinople. Nadia's account of what happened is fuzzy and clearly unreliable. Since homing is a much easier spell than sending, apparently Nadia, with Rachel's assistance, was able to accomplish it. We will likely never have the complete story of what Rachel did upon returning to her home DTAP. The historical record is, at the moment, clouded by glamour and impossible to make sense of. Lieutenant Colonel Lyons is expected to be home 3 days from now and may be able to supply some further details. Dr. Blevins was examined by Dr. Srinivasan in-house and discharged with oral and topical medications to control swelling and discomfort from the pepper spray. No permanent injuries are anticipated. Nadia has been placed on administrative leave pending the outcome of a more formal investigation. The biocontainment zone is still being scrubbed down as per protocol and is expected to be back in working order in time for Lieutenant Colonel Lyons' scheduled return.
After Action Report. Debriefer, Dr. Melisande Stokes. Doer, Lieutenant Colonel Tristan Lyons. Theater, Constantinople. Operation, Galata. Deed, Relic Relocation. DTAP, Para, Constantinople, July 1203. Strand. Fourth and last repetition of this deed. Note to readers. Refer to the reports on the first three repetitions of this deed for general background. The specific deed was to enter the abandoned battlefield tent of the Byzantine Emperor, secure a religious relic of importance to Orthodox Christians, and move it to a different tent so that it would be found by the Bishop of Halberstadt, M.S.
As I, Lyons, knew going into this, the battle for Galata Tower took place over the course of 2 days, and my deed had to be accomplished the first day. But I had to remain until the end of the second day before I could connect with our KCW to home me. This was my fourth strand prosecuting this deed, so at this point I knew, or thought I knew, what to expect. I'm passing as a member of the Varangian Guard. I've attained enough seniority and respect by this point that I'm working as part of the Emperor's personal guard. In peacetime, that means standing near him when he goes to church or whatever, but in wartime it means being near him on the battlefield. The battle strategy for both sides of this conflict is all over the wiki, so I don't need to explain that. The Emperor's so-called navy is in appalling shape. It's just a handful of ships literally rotting in the harbor, and the Emperor's army is an embarrassing joke, except for the Varangian Guard. We were camped out on the steep hillside that's north across the Golden Horn from the old walled city. The Golden Horn is the inlet that serves as the city's harbor. Across the Bosporus from us, so on the Asian side, is where the Crusaders had been camped since they arrived a few weeks earlier. The Emperor had sent emissaries over there to them with bribes and threats, telling them, "I'm the Emperor. Why are you trying to replace me with this punk kid nobody wants?" And the Crusaders' response had been, "Actually, no, we've got the real king right here in our pocket, and we're putting him on your throne." They didn't want to attack the city. They just wanted to get rid of the tyrant. There's two notable things about the hillside where we are camped with the Emperor. First, there's Galata Tower, which is a huge standalone structure right at the top of the hill. It's one of the best-sited strategic defenses I've ever seen. Archers can shoot at anyone approaching from the Bosporus, or the Golden Horn, or even the Sea of Marmara, or from inland. The single most important thing they're guarding is the chain that goes across the entrance to the Golden Horn. That inlet is so deep and narrow that it feels like a river mouth, more than a harbor. The chain is enormous. It's held up by a series of barges, and the only way to undo the chain is through a mechanism at the foot of the hill where Galata is. So the archers in Galata Tower, more than anything else, are there to keep invaders away from the mechanism that releases the chain. That's the defensive mantra of Constantinople. Nobody can scale the walls, nobody can break the chain, so what matters is, don't let anyone near the mechanism that releases the chain. If you're invading, if you want to get near the mechanism, you first have to take Galata Tower, which is pretty much untakeable. The other thing of note on the hill is Para, the Jewish neighborhood. On a map, you could draw a line east from Galata Tower across the Bosporus to the Asian shore, where the Crusader army was attacking from. You could also draw a line south from Galata Tower that would cross Para, then cross the Golden Horn to the Old City. We were camped outside the tower, close to Para. That explains why the Emperor and his army were in tents. Knowing that the Crusader attack was going to be directed against the Galata Tower, they had been deployed on the north side of the Golden Horn to protect it. On the morning of July 5th, it's no secret that the Crusaders are about to attack. We, the Emperor's army, are fully geared up. The tower is full of archers. On the hillside going down to the Bosporus are thousands of Byzantine soldiers fully armed and ready for the crusaders to attack. None of them were really worried, because when you're looking at that intense Bosporus current, it seems obvious that the crusaders could not cut directly across in those particular ships. Those ships weren't built for the Bosporus. They were built for Alexandria. They were never supposed to be anywhere near Constantinople. Even if they could get across, they would have to anchor in that current, which would be extremely challenging, and then disembark without first being picked off by our archers. That was not going to happen. They were sailing into their own destruction. Of course, I knew better, but I kept my mouth shut and just let it all happen. So the crusader ships approach us. The emperor gives the order for my contingent of VGs to reinforce the archers up in the Galata Tower. By the time I and my guys are up to where we have a decent vantage point, the archers in the tower are barraging the ships with fire arrows, regular arrows, stones. We're so sure we're going to annihilate them and litter the Bosporus with their shit-stained armor. But then something happened. The sides of the crusaders' ships broke open, and thousands of knights on horseback came leaping out of the holds, straight into the water. In that moment of the Byzantines' amazement, the archers on the boats began to shoot at us. After loosing one flight of arrows, they jumped into the water, ahead of the horses, with their bows and quivers held up over their heads, and as soon as they were in water shallow enough to keep their bowstrings dry, they began to shoot up the hillside. In full chainmail and some plate armor. As I said, this was my fourth strand, so I'd already seen it three times, but it was an astounding thing to watch. Makes footage of the Normandy landings look like nothing special. Then the same thing happened that had happened on every strand. The emperor turned and fled, and most of his army fled with him. There wasn't a battle. It was just them getting chased by the crusaders along the shore of the Golden Horn, about a mile inland, where there was a bridge across the water that the emperor's army crossed over and then burned behind them. The only part of the emperor's army that didn't flee was the tower garrison, which was largely Varangian guards, but also partially local conscripts. I was still there. The whole hillside, including the imperial camp, was emptied. I knew I had about an hour and a half before the crusaders returned. So I fulfilled my deed, went into the emperor's abandoned tent, got the relic, put it into the other tent so that it would be found by somebody we needed to be found by. So the deed was accomplished without incident, just as on the other strands. Now I just had to wait to rendezvous with a KCW, and since I know how things pan out, I know there will be a KCW in the crusader's army who can send me back tomorrow. That's what I had done the first three strands. I'd just have to survive through the rest of what's to come, without accidentally telegraphing anything to any of my cohort. So I re-enter the tower. Approximately 1 hour later, as I knew, the crusader army comes back and tries to get at the mechanism releasing the chain. But we have shitloads of arrows, and more important, fire arrows. More specifically, fire arrows made with Greek fire, which burns more when it touches water. So we're making them weep down by the casing to the chain release. Their squires are holding shields over their heads to protect them, with water-soaked hides over them, and we're lighting the fucking shields on fire. Their leader, the Marquis, finally calls them off. They pillage the Emperor's camp, and the right guy finds the relic I moved, so my deed is officially a success, despite what happened next, and spend the afternoon and evening hollering up to us in every language they can think of, trying to bribe us to just give up the tower. Obviously, we don't. So eventually they get drunk and squat in the Emperor's camp for the night, celebrating. They know there's only a couple dozen of us in the tower, and once they take us down, then they'll have Galata, which means they'll get into the harbor, which means they'll get into the city. They know tomorrow is theirs. But what they don't know is that all through the night, what looks like regular ferry traffic across the harbor is actually thousands of armed soldiers, disguised like ragmen and coal sellers and Jews and fishermen, sneaking across from the walled city, up the hillside by Pera, and into the tower. By dawn, we are all packed in like anchovies. It's a miracle nobody accidentally castrates anyone else. And the stench of all those bodies is so intense, it's almost psychotropic. The Crusaders think there's approximately 30 soldiers inside, when it's now nearly 100 times that. In the morning, we wait for the moment when the Crusader knights are getting geared up with their squire's help, and the grooms are saddling the horses. They all do it at the same time, which is ill-considered, because right at this moment, when they are all vulnerable, we hurl open the gates of the tower, and 1,000 soldiers burst out and rush the Crusaders, swords and axes swinging, spears flying. And at the same time, thousands more are shooting fire arrows down the slope at everyone on the ships, who thought they weren't even in the game today. We had a catapult on the roof of the tower that hurled boulders down into the Bosporus. They didn't hit any of the ships, but they made waves big enough to capsize the smaller ones. The whole Crusader army was almost literally caught with its pants down. Half of the Crusaders just fled because they were unarmed, or because they were servants whose pay grade didn't include armed combat. They scattered immediately into the woods beyond the camp. Meanwhile, there are hundreds of thousands of citizens of Constantinople sitting on the walls of the city, watching this from across the Golden Horn like it's reality TV. Most of them don't actually care who wins, because they understand it's just about who sits on the throne. They know the Crusaders aren't here to try to actually harm the city itself. All the potential emperors are assholes, and they're all related to each other. It hardly matters which one wins. So the citizens are literally picnicking and placing bets on who wins the day. Finally, the Crusader knights were mounted, and their foot soldiers got their heads together enough to finish armoring and grab their weapons, and we finally had full engagement. We still had the advantage of topography, because we were coming from the top of the hill, and they were down the slope. 2 Greek soldiers ran right up to the Crusader army, grabbed a lord, slashed him across the face, and began to drag him back toward the tower. But one of his knights went after him and hacked the heads off both of the Greeks, and brought the lord back to the safety of the crusading army. The whole thing happened in about 30 seconds. That shifted everything. Suddenly, the crusaders rose to the occasion, cheering and catcalling. And Christ, talk about a counterattack. None of our men had horses, and most of them were conscripted. They didn't want to be there. They had essentially no military training. So as soon as things got really heated, they deserted their stations. Some of them ran down to the harbor chain to try to pull themselves across the Golden Horn on it. It could take the weight. Those links were nearly as big as I am. But the Crusader archers picked them off easily. Remember, there's 250,000 people watching this for their morning entertainment. It was surreal. Abruptly, there's only 200 of us left, and we start to realize, of course, I knew this all along, that we better close the gates of the tower before the Crusaders come charging in. To be more precise, they have to close the gates. I have to get my butt out the gates and away from there. As much as it insults my military instinct, I can only meet my KCW if I get away from the tower, because all the Varangians in that tower are going down. So, just like the 3 times before, I push my way out during that moment of confusion, when the Varangians and the Greeks are trying to close the gates, while the Crusaders are trying to force them to stay open. I am wearing Varangian lamellar armor, relatively lightweight, so I have more mobility than the Crusaders whose ranks I have to break through. I jab at 2 of armpits and groins to encourage bodies to get out of my way, but my goal isn't to terminate anyone. It's just to get out of there. I know how it ends. My job is not to stick around for it. It's hard because I know some of those men pretty well now, and leaving them to their doom while I slip away to find a witch to send me home. We should consider getting counselors to help soldiers deal with that. It could fester into PTSD. The only other Varangian I see fleeing the tower is Magnus. He follows me out of the place. He's got his eye on me. I think he's expecting me to grab a boat oar and single-handedly mow down a few hundred armed knights or something. but in all of the confusion, it's easy enough for me to elude him. So I get out, away from the tower, and I watch. I watch the crusaders barely manage to pry the gates back open, and I watch them stream into the tower, and I hear the carnage inside, and I know what it means. That's when it happened. I knew what was supposed to happen next. The crusaders were supposed to go down and open up the casing for the chain mechanism, release the chain, and sail into the harbor, to the astonished horror of their 250,000 spectators. Then they send across the Bosporus for the rest of their camp, especially the women and the cooks. There's a KCW in the Crusader army, and she's supposed to send me back here. Meanwhile, the Jews of Pera are frantically packing their bags and hightailing it out of town to start the well-documented Byzantine diaspora. All of that is what happened 3 strands in a row. But this time something happens that has never happened before. There is a massive flash of light and an explosion on the harbor side of the hill, right exactly where Pera is. The entire hillside, all of Pera, which was built of stone, is flaming. This has never happened before. I have no idea why it's happening. Obviously, at the time, I didn't know that Rachel had come back to 1203 and meddled by telling people what was coming. I realized from the 1601 London detap that this has got to be diachronic sheer, and I knew I had to get as far away as possible. So I run toward the woods and wait to see what happens when all the fire and explosions die down. That happens very fast, actually, just like in London. I come back toward the tower for reconnaissance, and I see at once that 2 things are different from how they've always been. First, because of the explosion and fire and all that hell that broke loose, there's no way to release the chain mechanism. It's fused. That thing is never going to open. Ever. And just as I'm thinking about what a massive fuck-up that is, because without the chain being lowered, the ships cannot get into the safety of the harbor, and then, literally, history cannot move forward, and then the second thing I notice is that Pera is gone. Gone. Not even any foundation stones. It's obliterated. A black, charred spot, acres of it, on the hillside, as if there was never anything there. And that awful smell I remember from the Albigensian detap, that noisome smell of charred bones after an execution. The whole area, which had been walled and locked, went up so fast that nobody there had time to escape. Horrible. A quarter hour later, while half the army is still walking around in a daze, something incredible happened. The Eagle, the largest and heaviest iron-prowed Venetian ship, rammed into the harbor chain and broke it. They broke the harbor chain of Constantinople. That's not how it was supposed to happen. Invaders tried for 500 years to break the chains guarding the Golden Horn. Every generation of that chain was unbreakable. Something about the diachronic shear must have had a molecular effect on the metal and weakened the chain. I think the multiverse required the Crusaders to get into the harbor, and so made sure it happened, even if they couldn't do it the way they did on every other strand. Anyhow, neither side lost many men to the shear, but it freaked the hell out of everyone. Even being aware of the shear, I'm already feeling confused about what happened, so I'm sure all kinds of crazy things will end up getting said about it. I'm willing to bet everyone will say that Pera must have been made of wood to go up in flames like that, and the flames must have come from the fire arrows, something like that, even though I know Pera was made of stone and tile, and I also know the angle the fire arrows came from would never have landed in Pera anyhow. So lots of weird crap is going to get said. In conclusion, it appears Rachel was reunited with her family and warned them. This changed everything. Clearly Rachel's information moved quickly out of the Jewish settlement. There is no way we will ever know what Rachel said, or to whom, or what the person attempted to do with the information. We know only that the multiverse could not bear such a change of course, and eliminated its possibility.
Post by Dr. Melisande Stokes on All Dodo Odin Channel. Day 1812.
All. Mortimer has requested that everyone please stop checking the wiki for updates on Constantinople. It's slowing the servers down, and it is a waste of time until the glamour dissipates. Lieutenant Colonel Lyons and I believe that over the next few days, history will literally rewrite itself, as the oral accounts of that day's diachronic shear make their way into written testimonials, and then eventually history books, and finally the Internet. Rachel Bat Avraham almost certainly died in the shear. Although she died in defiance of our regulations, it is important to be sensitive to the grief of the many Dodo workers, especially her fellow Muons, who had the fortune and pleasure to have worked with her for the better part of 3 years. Respectfully submitted, Melisande Stokes.
Exchange of posts by Lieutenant General Octavian K. Frank, Dr. Constantine Rudge, and Dr. Roger Blevins on Private Odin Channel. Days 1810 through 1813, mid-July, Year 5. Post from Lieutenant General Octavian K. Frank.
Blev, C.C. Rudge. I've been following the traffic on this system as my schedule permits. Relieved to hear Lieutenant Colonel Lyons made it back in one piece. Somewhat confused otherwise. He accomplished the mission on all four strands. So how do we know whether it worked?
Response from Dr. Roger Blevins.
Aki, that is the fundamental question of all diachronic operations. How can we know the success or failure of a campaign such as this one, where the objective is to shift national borders a few kilometers or even a few meters to one direction or the other? In the present case, as you know, what we are trying to achieve is to pry Crimea loose from the Russians and get it back into the full and undisputed possession of Ukraine, all without firing a shot or engaging in military operations, as that term is normally understood. If the project succeeds, then our present-day reality changes. We wake up tomorrow and Ukraine owns the Crimea free and clear. Not only that, but history will have changed as well. We'll have no memory and no records of Russia ever having marched into Crimea in 2014. So how do we know that anything even happened? The answer is that the alteration of history doesn't happen in a flash. It takes a little while to propagate through all of the strands and whatnot. And during that time, there is this thing that Dr. Oda terms glamour, galvanic liminal aura antecedent to manifold rift, which even non-magical people can sense if it's strong enough.
From Dr. Constantine Rudge.
Just jumping in here with a note that Dodo's R&D division has invented ways of measuring glamour. That's why we had 3 spy planes in last year's budget. We mounted the glamour detection systems in their bellies, and even now they're flying routes over Ukraine gathering data.
From Lieutenant General Frank.
Yes, I remember the spy planes now, and the ruckus they caused in the budget hearing. Glad to know they're getting some use. Why can't we just draw a map or something and store it and then compare it to a current map a few days later? I know you're going to tell me it would change and there would be glamour, but is there no way to just store a document in such a way that it wouldn't change?
From Dr. Blevins.
That is being worked on, too. Apparently, if the map were stored in an ODEC, your idea might work. But because space in ODECs is so scarce and expensive, we have done very little of this.
From Lieutenant General Frank.
Seems to me we could get a hell of a lot of thumb drives into an ATO. Give me a sit-rep on those. Oh, and I noticed that when Rachel Bat Avraham flew the coop, she used mind control on the witch who homed her. Obviously, psyops is a common ability among the historical witches.
From Dr. Rudge.
Just a gentle reminder, General Frink, that we try to avoid using loaded terms such as mind control.
From Lieutenant General Frank.
Connie, you can call it whatever you want. Psyops has got to be simpler than what we just went through to get Crimea back.
from Dr. Rudge.
Yes, General Frink, Crimea is part of the Ukraine today. You may share with me a vague memory, rapidly fading, of a Russian invasion that never happened? As if we dreamed it, and the memory of the dream is being dispelled by the more concrete realities of the new day. Without disputing your opinion that the operation was anything but simple, I'll point out that to achieve the same result through conventional military operations would have been infinitely more complex and risky.
From Lieutenant General Frank.
I'll give you complex. Risky I'm less sure of. Hard to know what the real risks are.
From Dr. Blevins.
To answer a question earlier in this thread, the first ATO is proceeding through its testing routines more or less on schedule, but it is a device of many subsystems, and there are endless delays and complications around procuring special parts, debugging code, and so on. We are looking at bringing Grania forward in mid-September once we're certain the device works. In the meantime, we could certainly try some experiments with thumb drives or other forms of document storage, as you suggest. In the meantime, Aki, I would like to draw your attention to a question we were kicking around earlier, namely what to do with the surplus personnel in Lieutenant Colonel Lyons's department, including Lieutenant Colonel Lyons himself, now that the big push in the Constantinople theater is over. Do we wish to throw them into another colossal operation? Or sit back and assess?
From Lieutenant General Frank.
We'll give you a call in 5, Blev.
Tavian K. Frank, to all Dodo department heads. Day 1825, late July, year 5.
First of all, I would like to congratulate all Dodo personnel for the successful conclusion of operations in the Constantinople Theater. That is not to gloss over the tragic story of the late Rachel Bat Avraham. However, to the best of our ability to assess these things, it would appear that Dodo was able to undo a Russian takeover of the Crimea that, on our strand, never successfully happened. To have achieved a similar result using conventional trapezoid-style operations would have been immensely costly in both dollars and blood, and would have raised the possibility of opening a wider war. One of the measures of a successful team is the ability to adapt to unexpected complications that inevitably crop up during the course of a complex operation, the fog of war, as it were. Our glitch for this mission was the unexpected advent of St. Tristan of Tintagel as blowback from earlier operations in Normandy. While this made it seem touch and go for a short time, the situation seems to have resolved without further repercussions. Before many of you depart for well-deserved vacations during August, I wanted to supply an idea of top-level direction during the rest of this year and the year following. The Constantinople Theater has proved that with the help of the Chronotron, we can conduct large-scale operations that will reshape history to our advantage without the expense and bloodshed of conventional warfare. As you all know, Dodo is also conducting significant operations in 5 other theaters at this time. All of these are scheduled to wind down over the course of the autumn and early winter. Our general plan is to stand down, stand back, and appraise the results and lessons learned before plunging into additional theater-scale operations. With that, I wish you all a restful August. Sincerely, Lieutenant General Octavian K. Frink.
Post by Dr. Melisande Stokes to Lieutenant Colonel Tristan Lyons on Private Odin Channel. Day 1825.
I didn't think Frink could be that smooth.
E-response from Lieutenant Colonel Lyons.
Don't go there, Stokes.
From Dr. Stokes.
No, seriously. That was the nicest fuck you letter ever.
From Lieutenant Colonel Lyons.
He's a general. He fights wars. When the war is over, he stops fighting and puts his army to work training to fight the next war. That's all this is.
From Dr. Stokes.
I think being turned into a saint may have affected your judgment.
From Lieutenant Colonel Lyons.
So you're going to be the little devil on my shoulder?
From Dr. Stokes.
Smiley face.
from Lieutenant Colonel Lyons.
I'm out of here. Time for some R&R. See you in 3 weeks.
From Dr. Stokes.
Where are you going again?
From Lieutenant Colonel Lyons.
Probably shouldn't divulge this, but I'm going to Normandy.
From Dr. Stokes.
Colonnay.
From Lieutenant Colonel Lyons.
You got it. It's a nice place now. There's a B&B practically right on Thyra's home site. Going to go get drunk on cider and light a candle at the Chapel of St. Tristan.
From Dr. Stokes.
Light one for me.
From Lieutenant Colonel Lyons.
Roger Wilco.
Letter from Grania to Grace O'Malley. A Wednesday of Late Harvest, 1602.
Auspiciousness and prosperity to you, milady. So, at last, the time 'tis for me to reveal my plan to you in full. As good as all these fellows have been to me, both in London and in Antwerp, there's naught of use that comes of my remaining a spy for your grace when I've lost the chance to dawdle around Whitehall, and it's all these natural philosophers and bloody intellectuals I've got around me. And the fuggers, of course, but they at least are clear-eyed, so they are, about how to get things done in this world. I know your grace grows weary of the world, and sorrowful I am to think of your moving past us to the realms beyond. I've no premonition at all of what shall come of Ireland once you've left us, and I fear the English will renew their bloody conquering schemes, especially with the urging of Sir Francis Feckin' Bacon. So I hope it's understanding that your grace will be, when I tell you that I vowed to myself to look out for my own cause now, that being magic, and the fate of my sister witches. Sir Tristan Lyons trusts me as a sibling, and yet isn't he always refusing to tell me what stymies all magic abilities in future? So I'm thinking the best way for me to be learning such a thing is to go forward into the future myself and be looking at things from his vantage point. Glad I am to hear from within the network that Tristan's bosses think to bring me forward anyhow, to help them with a thing they call an atto, which is apparently exactly like the horrid little chambers their witches be spending all their days in, only not quite so little and on wheels, as if wheels would make it any better. I intend to use the resources of Tristan's own guild, what calls itself Dodo, not to restore magic, but to prevent its destruction in the first place, as soon as I ken what is the cause of such destruction. A brilliant plan this is, to my mind, and so obvious and straightforward. I wonder what bollocks excuse Tristan's superiors have for not be doing likewise. I know not how long a stretch of time there is between the death of magic and its rebirth, but that stretch is surely a boil on the face of history, and if it can be avoided, then it is my duty to see that happen. For surely the destruction of magic is not only bad for witches, but bad for Ireland and such like nations that are relying heavily on magic for self-defense from oppressors. So here then is my plan. Oft enough have I listened to Tristan and the other doers lament of a certain officer whose name is Roger Blevins. This gentleman, although little enough he seems to do, yet has more power than all the others put together, even including Tristan Lyons himself. Rose is of a mind with me, and it's sending me forward in time she's agreed to, so that I may ingratiate myself with this Blevins, and yourself knows well enough how easily I may ingratiate myself when it's ingratiating that is called for. And then, won't I be in a position to be learning things Tristan wouldn't have me learn, and won't he be helpless to prevent my learning? And so, my dear beloved pirate queen, I pledge my loyalty to you forever, and to the Irish cause, but it's off to the future I'm now bound. Whether I be near or far, may I hear only good things of you, my Lady Grace. Yours ever, Grania, no longer in England.
Incident report. Author,
Esme Overkleeft. Subject, Magnus. Theater, Northern Europe, Early Medieval, Nîmes. Operation, Botanical Infrastructure Ops for Magical Enhancement, Biome. DTAP, Colinette, Normandy, 1205. Filed, Day 1857, Late August, Year 5. Having completed my DD in Normandy, 1205 DTAP, Iris Germanica Rhizome grafting along La Vie River, I went to KCW Imblen of Collinet to be sent back to Dodo HQ. I have worked with Imblen on several occasions, and my Norman French allows us to have reasonably fluent conversations. As others who have visited this DTAP can attest, she is a calm, unflappable, good-humored woman. However, on this occasion, she was on edge. Magnus of Normandy, known to several of our doers, from DTAP's 1202 to 3 Constantinople, returned to his own village, some 50 kilometers from Collinet, after many years gone, which was a cause of celebration. However, Magnus was excessively preoccupied with querying everyone about their memory of a local song or folktale, about a great hero who had, several generations earlier, saved the village from attack by a feuding tribe and later been canonized by the church. The hero was named Tristan of Dintagel, an unremarkable enough name, except that Magnus met somebody named Tristan of Dintagel in Constantinople, 160 years after the events of the story. Magnus called the village elders into council and described this remarkable coincidence to them. They did not share his obsessive curiosity. He then traveled to Collinet to query Imblen, formally seeking her advice and assistance as a witch to make sense of this. He was excited and aggressive, and supplied many details about Tristan's recent activities in Constantinople, making it obvious that he had observed Tristan closely and recruited other members of the Varangian Guard to keep an eye on him. Imblen feels she said, "I can't help you," a little too quickly and firmly, because he became even more intrigued and declared that he would go to Dintagel directly to seek the parish, church, hundreds, records, and establish if his Tristan was a descendant of the hero, or if something stranger was happening. For the record, this is the fourth strand on which something like this has happened. Each time Imblen seems more shaken and Magnus appears more clear-headed and determined. This time, given what he understands of witches' powers, he hypothesized directly to Imblen that given Tristan's archaic speech patterns, perhaps another witch had sent Tristan forward in time, and if so, he would hie himself back to Constantinople to learn more of Tristan's doings, in case there could be profit for himself made from it. Respectfully submitted, Esme Overkleeft.
Exchange of post by Dodo staff on Anachron Management, Odin Channel. Days 1862 through 1870. Early September, Year 5. Post from Dr. Melisande Stokes.
Welcome back from vacation, everyone. I'm assuming you have all seen Esme Overkleeft's incident report? It sounds like Magnus knows too much. Should we consider bringing him forward?
Response from Macy Stoll.
Please keep in mind that the Anachron management team, which bears the brunt of looking after all of these people who are brought forward, is currently operating at capacity. Some Anachrons are easier to handle than others. If this Magnus is so burning with curiosity that he would traverse half the known world to pursue this matter, then he'll cause just as much trouble for us here if we bring him forward.
From Lieutenant Colonel Tristan Lyons.
Respectfully, Macy, if we bring him forward, we will at least have some oversight re his troublemaking. If that requires additional resources for the Anachron management team, then there are channels for requesting same.
From Dr. Roger Blevins.
Magnus's psych profile suggests he will probably be considered a nut job, possessed by demons, etc., by anyone in his era. While he might cause problems, they don't warrant us spending the resources on housing him here for the rest of his life. He isn't sophisticated enough to figure the whole thing out, or to be useful to us if he's here. It's not worth the resources to bring him.
From Lieutenant Colonel Tristan Lyons.
Respectfully, I can vouch for Magnus's abilities, having fought beside him on several occasions in Constantinople DTAPs. Contrary to Dr. Blevins's assessment, I cannot think of a better soldier to help train doers who will be operating in the Viking/Norman world. I should have proposed recruiting him already. My department has a number of physically active doers who are currently in turnaround. If we bring him forward, I'll be his minder until we've taken proper measure of him.
From Dr. Melisande Stokes.
Just bumped into Esme in the cafeteria. She had to do one more strand on DTAP 1205 Colonnae, and says Imblin reports that Magnus has now advanced his theory. Given that Tristan of Dintagel of legend came to Normandy as a fortune seeker, and then, as Magnus sees it, almost certainly came forward in time, he is evidence that time travel is an excellent way to seek one's fortune. Apparently, Magnus would like to employ the same method. He is asking Imblin what fee she would accept to send him in one direction or another. She has reverted to typical witch maneuvers of requesting impossible-to-get things. In this case, myrrh from the cradle of baby Jesus. He threatened her. Highly unusual behavior toward a witch. And she had to render him mute for an hour to put him in his place. Esme hasn't had time yet to file a full report, but I'll link in this thread when she does. Please reconsider bringing Magnus forward.
From Dr. Roger Blevins.
Anyone stupid enough to threaten an active witch will never get his head around what is really going on here. But since he is now a threat to one of our human assets, and Tristan seems to think he can contain him, I'll dispassionately second Melisande's suggestion to bring him forward.
From Lieutenant General Octavian K. Frank.
Have been monitoring this thread. Bring Magnus forward. Even if he doesn't figure anything out, we're dealing with the specter of diachronic shear if he says something to somebody more clever than he is. If we keep him busy as a combat instructor, he'll probably think he's died and gone to Valhalla.
Private message from Lieutenant Colonel Tristan Lyons to Dr. Melisande Stokes.
Don't correct him about Valhalla, Stokes. I know you want to. Don't.
Grania's Final Letter to Grace O'Malley, Part 1, Summer Solstice, 1603.
Faith and auspiciousness to your grace. It's a very long letter I'll be writing you this day, and the last one ever, for certain this time. I've been to the future and back again, so I have, and am about to go again, and this time I am quite certain there'll be no returning. So you'll never know the end of my story, your grace, but now in your closing weeks, before you cease to draw breath, it's a remarkable adventure I'm leaving you to dwell upon, that you might not forget your little Grania, as the veils lower between the worlds to receive you. So, to get on with the telling. Rose sent me forward, to the same place we have both so oft sent Tristan and the others. I arrived in a place so shocking that I doubt our fair language has words harsh and perverse enough to do it justice. As Tristan had already revealed to me, in this future day there's only a small airless chamber where magic's working, with just enough room for two people, barely larger than a garderobe it is. The walls are slick and peculiar, like tiles made of painted wood. And no smells in it at all. Not a one. How can that be? But 'tis nothing compared to what happens when the door of the chamber opes. 'Twould take me half a lifetime to describe to you the wonders and the horrors of the future world. The garderobe, what they call the Odek, is housed within a large chamber, a strange room with mechanical monstrosities and a dreadful buzz in the air, as if lightning were always just about to strike, a sound they are all indifferent to, much as I became indifferent to the odours of Southwark. And this chamber, in turn, is inside a vast building, which is on a street full of vast buildings in a city of streets with vast buildings. Larger than cathedrals, some of them, but without ornament or even shape. Like building blocks for giants, so they are. No imagination or love of beauty at all. Everything functions without human or magical assistance, but I confess most breathlessly that whatever power keeps humanity and its many mechanical servants humming, it is far more dazzling than any magic I have ever seen performed. And I tell you straight out, suspicious this makes me. For what is the cause to bring magic back when it has been replaced by something clearly more serviceable? So the first riddle I put my mind to was this. In a world where carriages travel without beasts to pull them, and food is effortlessly abundant, and there is ample light to sunder any darkness from all manner of peculiar torches, none of them given to burning down a place, even if it is all wood, and where all and sundry wear grander clothes than most anyone in London, and an astonishing variety, what's more, something there must be, some commodity or advantage that magic can attain, but mankind cannot yet. Nothing material can it be, for no magic I ever knew summoned such luxuries for royalty as everyday folk here take as commonplace. The environs are not the point of my tale, so I shall omit most of the gobsmacking details, but please know I will happily discourse upon it if you're requesting it of me, Your Grace. To the kingdom of heaven, I know you are bound soon, but it might not contain half the wonders of yon 21st century. So, to get to the telling, at last. Greeted I was by the lady-in-waiting of the Odek, the first woman ever I met of that time, in that time, and wasn't she strangely dressed, with teeth every bit as fine as Tristan's? When I gave her courtesy, why, she was astonished. For isn't my name one of glorious renown in the future? It is, sure. She proffered me a thick white cotton shift with a belt sewn into it, from a pile of them beside the door, and then a set of absurdly short stockings from another pile. Socks, she called them. Instructed me to don it all, and asked me to wait, as if I'd anywhere to go now that I'd arrived. Then she spoke directly to her desk, so she did, asking it to send her Lieutenant Colonel Lyons on account of Gronya had arrived from London. Within moments, there he was, my handsome fella, looking at me through a wall made of the most perfect glass that can be imagined, so smooth and flawless as to be invisible. He looked ever so bizarre in the weeds he must wear in that future time, monotone and snug, but shapeless. Not glorifying his marvellous shape, and yet neither hiding it for modesty, as priests are wont to do. 'Twas incredibly dull, he looked. After giving me a look up and down, he nodded as if to say, "Sure, that be Gronya," and then went to a door in the glass wall, out of my view. Meanwhile, I was hustled away by another young man with gorgeous teeth, who smelled like something I might like to lick, but refrained. Escorting me out of the room of the Odek, he did, under horrible illumination that buzzed fiendishly and made everyone look dead, along a corridor covered in some kind of short, stubby pelt, very firmly set upon the boards, and then into a room tiled with a marvellous substance, such as my stockinged feet had never felt before. It both gave way and yet slightly gripped the stocking. This room was blindingly bright and cold, everything made of metal, like an armoury, but even brighter somehow, as if everything were the colour of a new sword. Whole walls, like silver. Most peculiar it was. At this point, Your Grace, I wouldn't be lying to say that I was that fatigued and weak, as if all my humours were being slowly drained from me. It occurred to me that a good slumber would be most agreeable. As if he were reading my thoughts, the young man led me to a peculiar piece of furniture, something between a couch and a throne, a sort of upright divan, I suppose it was. 'Twas soft and padded and strewn about with blankets, and in other ways most inviting for one about to swoon. But then Tristan came.